Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The spy and assassin of Viet Nguyen's first Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer, is now in Paris, seething with bitter anger, traumatized by his time in a re-education camp in Vietnam, and preparing to, again, betray those closest to him. I am also, he tells us, a man of two faces and two minds, one of which might perhaps yet still be intact. The novel and our narrator are pulsing with outrage, sometimes pungent sarcasm, and the contradictions of international politics. Mr. Nguyen recently told The Guardian that those contradictions feel familiar. The narrator's personality, the fact that he's a man of two minds and two faces, is pretty much me too. As our guest joins us, I wonder if your own more recent immigrant experience has left you feeling the same, divided between the family history of your homeland and the experience of this new land. Viet Nguyen's new novel is titled The Committed, and he joins us this morning from Pasadena. Welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks so much for having me back.
I think it's really interesting about the way writers of different backgrounds, I was thinking of Luis Alberto Urrea, Leila Lalami, you, talk about this discomfort and this internal restlessness of being an immigrant and of feeling out of place wherever you are. You know, I've had writers tell me that's a very valuable perspective to be a writer, and I wonder if you found the same.
I think that's true. I'm not sure if how happy people become writers. If you're happy and everything feels like, you know, it is what it should be, what are you supposed to write about? So experiencing, you know, friction, displacement, discomfort, these are things that, you know, I think most people would probably rather not experience. And I'd rather not too, but the circumstances of my life and my own personality have lent me to feeling these things, to observing them, and it's very useful material for a writer.
You know, I was listening to a conversation yesterday about the border, the way Americans refer to often our southern border, and this was a, you know, this was a political conversation, but I thought the way we talk about in our political atmosphere this experience of what it means for people to leave everything that's familiar, maybe sometimes put a child on a transport up north across a border with the idea that you may never see that child again. You know, we have become, I think, quite good at distilling some of the humanity away from that and really thinking of this in isolation as a political problem. So I've been wondering, as you listen to this rhetoric develop and pick up steam again with a new administration, how you hear it?
I think that, you know, when we talk about these types of issues, there's so many things are mixed up into this. And certainly one of them is the question of humanity and how we think of people who are trying to cross borders. And I think for many Americans, it's easy to sort of take on the sort of callous expectation that, you know, we have to guard our resources, we have to guard our culture, we can't let all these people in. And we forget exactly what you mentioned, which is that it's heartrending and difficult for people to make these journeys. They're not doing these journeys because they want to come to this country and steal resources. They're making these journeys because they have very little choice. And I speak of this as, you know, as a refugee, a former refugee, Vietnamese person. And when you mention that families are sending children alone across the border, and this might seem alien to a lot of Americans, I have to say the Vietnamese people did the same thing. There were Vietnamese refugees who were just adolescents. They had been sent out alone onto the open seas by their families to be anchors, that if they could get to another country, they could bring the rest of the family with them. And it's ironic for me that there are Vietnamese people out there who are former refugees who have forgotten about this experience. You know, they've forgotten their own humanity, and they look at these newer people trying to cross the southern border, and they don't want to let them in, and they've forgotten that they came from the exact same kinds of circumstances. The last thing I'll say is that I think that we as a country actually have the resources to take in many more refugees and immigrants than we do. But we live in an economy of scarcity and fear, where our resources are being not equally distributed, and people feel as if they have to guard what they have. And so we can't disattach our phobias and our fears of newcomers from the fact that we live in a society of deliberately cultivated inequity, where many of us feel that we have to fight for scarce resources, and that's simply not true.
I understand what you're saying about this perception of scarcity, and I do understand about the inequities with the wealth gap in this country. But I also look at our history and the way different waves of immigrants have been received and treated. And I wonder if there would ever be a moment when Americans felt satisfied enough, fulfilled enough to not engage in the kinds of conversations about scarcity and guarding resources that we're hearing yet again now.
Well, I think that there have been those moments in American history where Americans felt that they had enough. Okay, so let's look, for example, at the period after World War II, and you know, with this great expansion of the American economy, and that was distributed to a lot of Americans in the form of very high tax rates, for example, and in the form of things like the GI Bill. Now, when we look at that period, Americans embraced that kind of social and economic program, but we also have to be very clear that that was a highly racially distributed form of economic benefit. Like Black veterans, for example, didn't get the benefits of the GI Bill. Racial discrimination was still taking place. So we have to get to a point in our society where, number one, we acknowledge collectively that we need to support everybody in this country, and that, number two, we have to get over these fears that have been deeply embedded in our country of racial exclusion and racial othering, where the economic and the racial are completely intertwined with each other. So it's obviously very hard. I understand your question. It's obviously very hard to get to that point. But, mm-hmm. you know, as an idealist, I think we should try to mm-hmm. do that because the targeting of others, whether they happen to be, you know, Black people who have been here for centuries, or whether they happen to be new immigrants coming across borders, that's really an endemic American problem.
I don't want to miss what you referred to a little earlier when we were talking about what it means to put a child on a boat, as you say, Vietnamese families felt they had to do, or to be somebody in Guatemala who puts a child on a train or a transport to come north over the border, what that means. You had a version of that experience, didn't you? Although I think your family came together to a refugee camp in Pennsylvania. Remind me.
Yeah. Well, you know, first thing I got to say is we had a dramatic escape story from Vietnam, but so did every other Vietnamese refugee who left the country. So I don't think our story is particularly extraordinary. But, you know, we in April of 1975, we had to flee the country along with 130,000 other Vietnamese refugees because we were on the losing side of that war. And we ended up in Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania. There were four camps set up to hold Vietnamese refugees, and that was one of them. And in order to leave the camp, you had to have an American sponsor. And for whatever reason, no sponsor would take all four of us. So my parents were taken by one sponsor, my brother by another. He's 10 years old. I was four. I was taken by a third sponsor. And so that's where my memories begin, being separated from my parents. And that was being done for benevolent purposes. You know, my parents needed time to get on their own two feet and all of that. But when you're 4 years old, you don't understand that. So I understood that to be abandonment. And that was a very, you know, searing experience for a four-year-old at the time, which is why when I think about, you know, what happens to families at our southern border who are being deliberately broken apart, and, you know, children are being taken away from their parents and possibly being lost in our bureaucratic system for months and months at a time, I know that that will forever scar these children and their parents. And I never actually, you know, thought about my parents and what they thought about all of this until I became a father and my son turned 4 around the time of the so-called Muslim ban. And that was my opportunity to see myself through his eyes, but also to see my parents at that time and to realize I would never stand to have my children taken away from me. Even the very thought of it is painful to me. So I have such great empathy for the parents in this experience as well.
I know. I mean, how long did you live with a host family before you were reunited with your parents and your siblings?
Well, to me, it felt like forever to me because when you're 4 years old, you know, days feel like forever. But it was really only a few months. Huh. And my brother, though, who was 10 years old, didn't get to come home for 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And so he tells me, that's how we know mom and dad love you more, because they couldn't stand to be separated from you for so long.
But those are very formative years for your brother. I mean, what does he say about what it meant to live in a different, I mean, did they in some ways imprint his experience of, you know, who he is and what it meant to be in this country on him? And maybe that's still influential today.
Oh, you should have him on and ask him.
That would be interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, we're an emotionally reticent family. So he actually has never really talked about it with me. You know, he came out of it, at least externally, as an American. You know, he was doing all American activities as this boy in Pennsylvania. And then when we moved to San Jose, California a few years later, you know, he went to a public high school. And within 7 years after arriving in the United States with no English, he graduated as valedictorian of his school and went to Harvard. He's one of this early generation of Vietnamese refugee success stories. So externally, at least, I think he coped with it, as we all had to do. But I think I'm sure it left an imprint on him. You know, now he's turned into, you know, he's a doctor, he's a professor, but he's also turned into a political activist advocating for many of the same things that I advocate for. So I think we recognized that our refugee experience was transformative, both in giving us extreme levels of motivation to try to succeed in this country, but also with a deep awareness of the inequities of this country and what brought us here as well.
You mentioned earlier being disappointed and finding it ironic that there are Vietnamese immigrants or maybe second generation, first and second generation immigrants from Vietnam who now look at what's happening at the border and say the country can't afford what's going on. They need to stay in their own countries. You know, I've been thinking a lot about assimilation and how that's going to fit into the political, you know, ramp up again of this debate. I wonder if that is for many immigrants just an inevitable part of assimilation. My story is more unique than yours, and I did it, and I came here, and I fought to become whatever it means to be an American, and I'm questioning or cynical about, you know, you being able to do that. I mean, do you think that comes in some ways with what it means to assimilate? Maybe it's a dark side of assimilation. What do you think?
Well, I think if we look at, for example, at the former administration, and we see people like John Kelly and Stephen Miller, who are only one or two generations removed from their own immigrant history, and we see that they, in various one degree or another, maybe reluctantly with Kelly, but certainly vociferously with Stephen Miller, participated in this effort to close down the border and to demonize immigrants and refugees. We can see that Vietnamese refugees are not unique in this transformation of themselves into forgetful Americans who would like to close the door behind them. So I think there is something about, maybe it's just human nature, but also particularly about the American immigrant experience, where the second and third generations forget their immigrant ancestries, except for, you know, St. Patrick's Day and, you know, to celebrate certain kinds of cultural customs. But otherwise, to see themselves either fully as Americans or aspirationally fully as Americans. I mean, John Kelly is an American, unquestionably. And these second and first generation Vietnamese immigrants, some of them want to be fully Americans. And part of the way they participate in that is becoming anti-immigrant. Now, of course, when you're a Vietnamese refugee or a Vietnamese immigrant, I'm sorry to say, the chances of you being seen as fully American by the rest of the country are not great. But that doesn't prevent some people from participating in xenophobia to try to distance themselves from other people who are even less American than they are.
And I assume you say that because you wear your family history and your identity on a face that I think you're going to tell me many Americans will never believe is fully American. Is that right?
I am fully American. You know, I feel fully American. I spent every year of my life in this country except my first 4 years. I'm a citizen. I'm pretty sure my English is better than 99% of other Americans out there.
I'd agree with that. Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, my fate as an American is partly out of my control. You know, no matter how many op-eds I write, how many books I publish, how many prizes I win, there's still going to be the fact that some Americans will have great difficulty in seeing someone with my name, Viet Thanh Nguyen, and seeing that name as an American name. And this is structural to the United States. In other words, when you started off our conversation talking about, you know, feeling culturally divided, split into, mm-hmm. it's not simply a cultural matter. It's that division cannot be resolved by culture. That division can only be resolved by political recognition of the fact that this country has been built on a contradiction. The contradiction between everything we love about this country in terms of its beautiful ideals about democracy, equality, pluralism, assimilation, and so on. And the fact that all of these wonderful ideals have been built on a history of conquest, colonization, bloodshed, genocide, slavery, all these things that a lot of Americans want to forget about and want to deny, and which I insist is a fundamental part of our country. And that's why someone like me, who is not white, is going to meet resistance from a certain segment of the American population that can't fully confront this history.
You know, you used the word forgetfulness a minute ago, and I think that forgetfulness goes a lot of ways, takes a lot of different shapes, because there may be the forgetfulness of my family came here a mere 40 years ago, and now I don't want those other families from Mexico coming here. But what you've just described is also American forgetfulness, I think, in pursuit of American exceptionalism. This idea that we're exceptional and we got there in all of the good ways and none of the kinds of ways that you've just described. But, you know, the mythology, it depends in some ways on that forgetfulness of how we got here, doesn't it?
I think so. I think that part of the American hope is that, you know, we have this seemingly new country that anybody can come here and be what they want, and they can shed the allegiances and the blood ties and the conflicts of whatever world that they came from. And part of that involves forgetting, leaving things behind. And certainly if you talk about the Asian American experience, there's a lot of truth to that, because in Asia, people don't call themselves Asians for the most part. They call themselves by whatever nationality or ethnicity or religion that's important to them. And of course, Asians have fought terrible wars with each other. But here in the United States, at least by the second generation, a lot of that is forgotten. So we don't harp upon the fact, for the most part, that the Japanese, you know, colonized China and Korea, for example, and said here, Japanese and Chinese and Korean Americans can become Asian Americans and leave that past behind. So there's something wonderful about that. But the problem with forgetting is that simply because you decide to forget the past doesn't mean that the past has forgotten you. So it may be possible to leave behind what happened in Asia and Europe, but in the United States, we have forged our own history. And so when I talk about things like colonization, that's not of the European past. I'm talking about colonization here in the United States that is a part of our history. We can try to forget it by not talking about it, but the legacies of colonization are embedded in every aspect of our lives. Arguably, colonization is still happening if you ask indigenous peoples, and I agree with them in that case. You know, and we ignore that as well. We ignore that at our peril, because simply by trying to pretend something doesn't exist doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
I also wonder what you think of the character of the myth of exceptionalism about America and how it compares with the kind of nationalism that you might find in a country like France, one of the country that your new novel is set in, or, you know, your family's homeland of Vietnam. Is there something different, unusual stubborn, blind. What would you say? Give me some adjectives about how you describe how core this idea of being exceptional is to how we Americans see ourselves.
Well, I think every nation obviously wants to see itself in the best possible light and will construct cultures and mythologies around these set of beliefs. So I don't know how unique Americans are in believing that they're unique. You know, like everybody tends to do this. Mm-hmm. What sets Americans apart, I think, is that their mythology is reinforced by the actual power of the United States, mm-hmm. that we are a global power. We have enormous economic and political might and so on and so forth. Now, that being said, you know, if you look at Vietnam and the Vietnamese people and, you know, they have a parallel set of ideas. You know, if you talk to Vietnamese people, for example, you know, and you talk about things like war and conquest, you'll hear from them pretty soon that, hey, we were colonized by the Chinese for 1,000 years and we fought those people off and we became this powerful, became this independent country. Almost none of the Vietnamese will mention to you that in becoming Vietnamese, in becoming modern Vietnam, the Vietnamese conquered the Cambodians and the Cham and took away their land. The whole southern half of Vietnam is conquered land. Mm. But they don't want to talk about it, just as Americans don't want to talk about how, you know, we have the United States because of conquest and bloodshed. And likewise with France, of course, they themselves have been an imperial country, colonized Africa and Asia, and they did so under the rubric of the civilizing mission. That's what they called it. And they have their own great democratic traditions. They had their own great democratic revolution. And yet that is completely in tension with what they did in Africa, in Asia, in Haiti, for example. They used the civilizing mission to justify all kinds of very uncivil behavior. I mean, they dehumanized their colonized peoples. And by so doing, they allow themselves to do horrifying things. And so, you know, one of the things I say in the Committed is that when he first gets to France, our narrator arrives at Charles de Gaulle Airport and he says, wow, it's named after one of the greatest Frenchmen in recent memory. He liberated the French from the Nazis at the same time that he was continuing to enslave us Vietnamese. You know? I was like, oh, that's a contradiction. And contradiction is the perpetual body odor of humanity. And that's exactly, you know, that's the kind of territory that I love to explore as a writer. I don't just criticize Americans who are criticized by me, you know, sometimes their hackles get raised and, you know, they get very defensive. And all I want to say to them is, look, I say the same things about the Vietnamese and the French. My project as a novelist is not to single out Americans, but to single out these hypocrisies that we all share.
You are an equal opportunity, how should I put this, suffering no fools or hypocrites.
Right? Well, I hope so.
Writer. I think that's right. Vietan Nguyen is with us this morning. We're talking about his new novel, The Committed. It's a kind of sequel to his first novel, which won a Pulitzer Prize, called The Sympathizer. And we're talking about a number of the themes and the questions and the ideas and ideals that are foundational to the novel. Claudia wrote in to say, moving to the United States meant that I could finally be myself. In Chile, being LGBTQ is only legal on paper. You'll face discrimination in every single aspect of your life. You can't get married. Your rights are not the same as a straight person's. Here, I could be myself. I was able to marry whom I love and not be afraid of backlash. Unfortunately, I realized that there's a lot of violence here, too. Sarah wrote in to say, immigration meant leaving very tight-knit family behind in search of safety and a better life. I grew up learning English and Spanish simultaneously. It was a challenge early on, but also a blessing. My parents had to learn English, a new system of life, school and services, work, finding a home. They worked twice as hard for a fraction of the pay that they deserved, and they also faced disparaging remarks because of their accents. A call here from Heather in Minneapolis. Hi, Heather. Good to have you on the phone.
Thanks so much for this really intriguing conversation. I have a question about this term assimilation. I keep hearing you use this word, and I wonder if acculturation might be more appropriate, or if, you know, this is a question for Mr. Nguyen, if in your immigrant experience, if the difference matters. I guess to me, assimilation really speaks to forgetting, to your conversation about forgetfulness, really speaks to forgetting about one's home culture, whereas acculturation to me says more about really honoring and finding a way to integrate your home culture with this new American experience.
I love the question, Heather. Thanks.
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think that what Heather put forth is an important point, that one of the things that happens to immigrants and to refugees is often this expectation that they will shed everything from wherever it is that they came from clothing to names to languages and food, and become American, whatever that means. And part of the forgetfulness is that whatever we think of as American now is actually the result of earlier generations of integration, of conflict, of hybridization, any number of terms of where cultures got mixed. And because we're forgetful people, we forget that the things that we take for granted now were not taken for granted in the past. And so one of the things that immigrants and refugees do to the United States is that they also change this country in as much as the country changes them. If we go back to the example of my name, for example, I've you know, written about the fact that, you know, Viet Thanh Nguyen is not seen as an American name by many Americans, but the struggle is to make Americans say this name, and not just my name, but many, many names like mine, and in that sense, to change America as well. So Nguyen, the last name right now, when we first got here in 1975, obviously 99% of Americans didn't know how to say it. Now we're getting to a point where, you know, white people are saying to me very proudly, yes, you know, we know many Wins in our community, and it's the most common. It's like the fourth most common surname in this place, et cetera, et cetera. So we're starting to have an impact, even at this level of a name that would be considered extremely alien 50 years ago. That's just one example, and of course the other example is Vietnamese food is awesome. If you haven't eaten Vietnamese food, you're missing out. You know, and it's becoming a part of American cuisine. So a few examples of how it is that immigrants and refugees also, through this process of acculturation, change the United States as much as they are changed.
We mentioned what were known as boat people a little earlier in our conversation. The Committed's narrator goes on this wonderful kind of riff and I don't know, personal, you know, investigation, I guess, of what comes with being thought of as a boat person. And I have to say, I remember this when I was a kid, that my parents' Lutheran church in Western New York sponsored boat people. And I remember that the church was very proud of, you know, kind of stepping in as a saving force and helping the boat people. And that was all we knew about. They were boat people. That was like the full definition. This was really, I've never thought about it again, and this was really eye-opening in The Committed. So I'd love to hear you tell me how you worked through some of the ideas that our narrator raises.
Well, I was never myself a boat person. I mean, that official classification, even though when we fled Saigon on April 30th, we in fact left by barge. But that term hadn't been invented yet. And like you, I grew up aware of this term, the boat people, because by the late 1970s, when Vietnamese refugees started to flee en masse by boat, I was 6, 7, or 8 years old, and I was reading the news, and I could see this term, and I could see the images of desperate Vietnamese refugees. And, you know, the impression you get when you hear this term and when you see these images is that these are desperate and frightened people. And that's not really a full capturing of their complex humanity. That's just one dimension of that experience. And of course, I grew up in a Vietnamese refugee community where I could see the complex humanity of these people. And I knew some of their stories, and I knew that they were so much deeper than what the Western media was portraying them as, and certainly much deeper than how many Americans and people the world over knew about these folks. And so it bothered me for a long time, in the same way that a lot of representations of Vietnamese people in the media and in movies and so on bothered me, because I knew they were so inadequate. And I just knew that the term boat person carried all these these very objectifying and pitying connotations. Right. Yeah. And if you've never been the subject of objectification and pity, then maybe you don't understand how demeaning that can be, because pity seems like a good thing. You know, hey, we're going to help you because we feel pity for you. But I don't think anybody wants to feel pitied.
Yeah, I think I really thought about this. I think the conversation back in, you know, in among our church was this is part of a Christian mission. This is an important moment for the church to step forward and be involved. All good intentions. But I remember some of these families ultimately joining the congregation and always being thought of, I think, as those poor people that came over here on a boat and will never have, you know, what real Americans have and will always need our largesse. Again, all good intentions. You know, I don't want to say that that wasn't the case, too.
And I think, of course, that many of these people, the refugees who came to this country and were sponsored by churches and by individuals and families and so on, are in fact deeply grateful for this hospitality and this generosity, because that's what that is. But at the same time, you know, I think that some of them can also recognize and feel very complicated feelings about condescension and cultural insensitivity and things like that. All these things can happen at the same time, which is what makes it a complicated situation for many refugees, wanting to, you know, feeling genuinely grateful, but also wanting to, like other human beings, express their I don't know if resentment is the right word, but their dislike of being condescended to.
Right, right. And moving out from underneath one part of the story of who they are. You know, I wonder if Syrian refugees, I'm thinking of how we're doing this again, and maybe that's just part of the history of, you know, refugees coming to this country. But that's how we describe Syrian refugees too, right? I mean, very few of us know anything about the lives that people led in Syria. And I think the sum total of our knowledge about that might be, you know, they got caught up in this terrible civil war and they left everything they had and they spent time in a refugee camp and they have nothing and they're starting over. Yes, that is probably a part of the story. But I can imagine Syrian refugees doing what you've said about Vietnamese refugees coming here and being eager to move out from under some parts of that story. Does it make sense the way I'm putting it?
No, absolutely. And of course, we wait for the Syrian storytellers to tell Syrian stories.
Right,
it's not as if stories
right.
can't be told about Syrians, but of course, it's so much of it is framed when we're talking about Western media reportage around the urgency of this crisis. And of course, we want to talk about how desperate these people are because we want to help them. But, you know, that's that. And of course, people want to be helped, but imagine if here in the United States something like this were to happen and people were displaced as refugees, which happens, you know, we of course have stories covering what has happened to these people when their homes are burnt down, when they're flooded out.
New Orleans, but, you know, Katrina.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we also have stories that tell their stories, you know, because the reporters and the journalists and so on see them as human beings, understand their entire background, give them the opportunity to flesh out who they are, and we get a very different sense. They're not just desperate and frightened people. They're our fellow human beings, our fellow citizens, and we can see the complexity of their worlds. And so when it comes to people who are not Americans, we have to engage in this imaginative act to try to construct their humanity, which they obviously already have, but which is not being exposed to us or given to us. So that's why, you know, it's so necessary that we have storytellers, you know.
Right.
Like, I know that the impulse for a lot of immigrants and refugees is to get to this country or any country and set down economic roots and become economically successful. That's obvious. It's very crucial. But we need the storytellers to
like
tell these stories. Well, not just like me, but many, many people, you know, because, you know, we cannot claim our humanity without our stories. And so I just make a huge pitch out there to all the immigrant and refugee parents out there. You know, just don't force your kids to be doctors and lawyers and engineers. If they want to be artists and storytellers, let them cultivate them, grow them until they can grow up and write scathing autobiographies featuring you. That is part of the price.
That is so refreshing to hear that, right? There is not only one path to making it in America. I love that. So I've asked you to read a couple of paragraphs from this section of the novel. The narrator has arrived in, he's been in Paris for, I don't know, some time. And I think it also gives us this, oh my gosh, this acerbic voice of the narrator, which I don't know if this is your... You don't sound like this in conversation, but I mean, maybe this is just one side of you being totally unleashed. I loved it. I love the voice of this narrator. So tell us a little bit about where we are, if you will, and then we can hear the excerpt.
Sure. Well, you know, he's arrived in Paris in 1982, and he's living with his so-called aunt. She's not really his aunt, but that's another story. But his aunt is a member of the elite. You know, she's mixed race. She's French and Vietnamese, but she's an editor at this high-powered publishing house. She hangs out with all of these left-wing socialist politicians and intellectuals. And here he's at a party, and he's just been condescended to by this left-wing socialist politician known only as BFD, and this is going to be his response to the condescension. He aimed his finger at me, as if his words were not quite enough. I forced myself to smile and swallowed my resentment, which tasted like blood. That is to say, not as bad as you might imagine, given how so many people apparently enjoy dining on rare, juicy meat. The heat of his pity was so strong that it did not make me feel warm. Instead, I boiled, the steam hissing from my ears as I kept my mouth closed after the few conciliatory words I could manage. How could I say that the so-called boat people had already helped themselves by getting on their boats in the first place? How could I say that I refused to be called a boat person, a term so overpowering that even the anglophobic French had simply borrowed and worn it on a regular basis like un jean and le weekend? I was not a boat person unless the English pilgrims who fled religious persecution to come to America on the Mayflower were also boat people. Those refugees just happened to be fortunate that the soon-to-be hapless natives did not have a camera to record them as the foul-smelling, half-starved, unshaven, and lice-ridden lot that they were. In contrast, our misery was forever recorded in L'Humanité, where we were seen as anything but human. No, the boat people were not human. They did not get the benefit of some romantic painter casting them in oils, standing boldly on the prow of their sinking ships, facing the monstrous elements with the nobility of Greek heroes, enshrined in the Louvre to be admired by tourists and studied by art historians. No, boat people were victims, objects of pity fixed forever in newspaper photographs. Part of me, my mama's baby, wanted that pity. But the part of me that was a grown man neither wanted nor deserved pity, neither wanted to be called a victim nor deserved to be seen as such, not after all my deeds and misdeeds. If the price of being human was to be recognized through being pitiful, then to hell with humanity.
May I say that I can imagine you writing that passage and sitting back with a, oh, job well done. It's just so wonderful. It's wonderful. Let me grab a call from Abdi Salam in Fridley. Hi, Abdi. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. My question is relating to immigrants who sacrifice, you know, everything, or who run up from very difficult situation, come to the United States, more or less make it, you know, in life, and then seeing that they are not able to establish kind of the cultural environment when it comes to the language, you know, the culture, the storytelling, some of the themes that our speaker has eloquently described. And then you see them kind of hesitancy to going back home, not place that they came from, and probably still not stable. I'm referring specifically to Somalia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that hesitancy of I'm going back home to build and to help my community versus your community right here needs your help. If you have, let's say you have the technical skills or the education and the knowledge, why not invest in here and establish institutions rather than going back to a place that you left in a very difficult situation? So just that struggle of worrying about the future of their children in keeping their identity and you know, establishing themselves here with intact cultural values and norms with the limited resources that they have. So that, I'm just kind of thinking about what the author will say about that.
I'm so glad you called, because that was an element that we had not yet talked about, this pull, be it back to the homeland, to bring the advantages and the skills that you've gained in this country.
Well, I think that I really appreciate the question and the comment, because for Vietnamese people, the dilemma is pretty much exactly the same. I think for a lot of first generation Vietnamese people, Vietnamese refugees and immigrants, they came here as teenagers and as adults. There's a strong connection to the homeland for obvious reasons. And when the homeland is in need because of floods and poverty and illness and all these kinds of things, Vietnamese refugees and immigrants have responded, you know, by sending money, by returning to build foundations and charities and hospitals and churches and all these kinds of things. And I think that's a necessary kind of work to be done, because when we look at our communities here and then we see that, you know, there's poverty here and things to be addressed, but there's even greater poverty and desperation in the country of origin than we feel the tug to return. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't also build our community organizations and cultures here in the United States. And sometimes that's left to the 1.5 generation. That is people like me who were born elsewhere, but grew up here. And certainly my friends and I have done our best to build various kinds of cultural, political, economic organizations that are definitely, focused on the United States. So I think we do both kinds of things, but the divide between the two is not like a wall. I think there's fluidity. Because a lot of what we do here in the United States, for example, is done with the awareness that, you know, we can also build connections with what's happening in Vietnam as well. And it's not even so easy to reduce this to a first and second generation issue, because in fact, there are first generation people who are deeply invested in American politics and culture. And there are 1.5 and second generation people, my generation and younger, who have actually gone back to Vietnam. So, for example, the Vietnamese film industry is stocked with Vietnamese Americans, you know, wow. Actors and filmmakers and directors, producers who found obstacles here in Hollywood, in the United States, and they decided to go back to Vietnam, and they became movie stars, and they became the, you know, directors of their own movies. And so that's a reflection of sort of some of the inequities of the United States. It's not as if the movement from outside to inside the United States is unidirectional, but sometimes people face obstacles here and they see further opportunities back home and they go back. So there's a circulation that's taking place that's obscured by this idea of assimilation or that people only come to the United States and leave everything else behind. But that's actually, I think, never really been true in American history. There's always been a lot of circulation back and forth. There's always been people who've come here and gone back. And sometimes the second and third generations feel the pull of the ancestral homeland, both for nostalgic reasons, but also sometimes because there's more opportunity and excitement there.
I understand that our narrator is coming back to the United States. So he's been in France. He is returning to the United States. Is that right? There is one more novel coming? Where he's back
one
here.
One more novel. Yeah, I'm okay. I'm pretty sure that's the end. I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah, I think you have to know when to make an exit. And I'm pretty sure the exit will be spectacular. But he has to come back to the United States to make amends and to seek revenge. You know, if you've read The Sympathizer, you know that he did some terrible things in that book.
Yes.
And he ran away from the United States to escape some of these things that he has to come back to confront. I mean, The Committed is the novel in between. And let me just say to the audience out there, you know, if you haven't read The Sympathizer, I don't know why you haven't. I have no idea why you haven't read The Sympathizer. If you haven't, you can still read The Committed without that. It's been written in such a way that you don't have to do that. But The Committed is the novel where he deals with, you know, the fallout from the sympathizer, and he has to, you know, he's a damaged man, and he has to reconstruct himself. And in the final installment in the trilogy, this reconstructed self will go back to the United States, and it'll be the mid to late 1980s. And as a child of the mid to late 1980s, I think there's so much there to be talked about, in terms of, you know, Reaganism and Star Wars and crack epidemics and Iran-Contra that I'm just really dying to put into that final installment.
Wow. You know, I just have to tell you that he is one of the most ominous and disturbing characters that I've spent time with. You know, he's so multidimensional, but the trauma that he's endured, the things that he's done, the conscience that he has, I'm going to have to steel myself, Viet, for the next time I spend time with him. So I've got a little bit of time.
I can live with ominous and disturbing, you know, but let me just say in my own self-defense, I think he's kind of funny. And,
yes,
you know, people make a
it's
lot
a bitter out of, some humor.
Of bitter humor, but people make a lot out of, you know, some of the highfalutin ideas that are in this novel. But let me just say that, you know, one of the most important sources of inspiration for this novel was that American movie classic, Dumb and Dumber, by the Farrelly brothers.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a specific moment in this novel that alludes to that movie. If you've seen it, you'll understand the connection. But, you know, I think I really try to make an effort to go high and low, to be both political and satirical and entertaining at the same time.
Oh, my gosh. And mission accomplished. I always look forward to these conversations. Thank you so much for spending the hour with me. I really appreciate
Thanks, Carrie.
It.
Sure, a lot of fun.
Novel is called The Committed.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.